Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Reyes, Judge Flory, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you, and good morning. Our first case this morning is the County of Dakota, XL Michelle, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Heinz versus Brian Arthur Rittweiger. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. It's my understanding that the two respondents are splitting their time evenly. And I know after discussing with the marshal that you would envision 6.5 each, but I don't think you want to give us 2 minutes. So I think I'll just make it 7.5 for each of you. And then finally, obviously, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. The only thing I want to mention is that this oral argument is being recorded. And so you will have an audio version of the argument available, I think, no later than tomorrow. However, our court rules prohibit anyone from making their own audio or video recordings. So please keep that in mind. And that also applies to anyone who is observing as a guest. With that, counsel for the appellant, if you can unmute yourself, and whenever you're ready, you just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, and then you may begin. Mr. Seeloff, I think it's in the bottom left. There you go.
There it is. Got it.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I have with me Shelley Jotblad, my legal assistant in the office here for the court's information. I am the attorney representing Brian Rittweiger, the appellant.
Thank you.
In this appeal,
excuse me,
child support order.
Yes. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt. Wait.
In this appeal of a child support order by a magistrate, that is the June 120 order, and the appeal of the district court order on review, that is the 72920 order, the appellant is requesting that this court, the Court of Appeals, vacate those orders and remand the case to the trial court with certain instructions. What we're asking this court to do is to instruct the trial court to find that the appellant was, at least since January 1 of 2019, totally and permanently disabled due to a military service-connected disability as defined by the Code of Federal Regulations, which is cited in my brief, which means that the appellant cannot follow any substantial gainful employment. We are also asking that this court remand the case with instructions that the trial court can base child support only on the appellant's actual income, which is $3,492 per month in the VA pension. That's the increased level of the VA disability pension based on total disability, which he is now receiving, and not use potential income. For the obvious reason, for one of the reasons is that if he's totally and permanently disabled, that he is not able to have any other income. And further, the statute does not allow a combination of imputed or potential income and actual income. The statute clearly says that if the thresholds are made for imputation of income, it must be based solely on the imputation and not with actual income. We are also asking the trial court to redetermine the respondent's income and to instruct the trial court to apply equitable principles in their decision. Now, this is extremely important because the trial court, both on the review level and on the initial hearing before the magistrate, refused to apply any equitable principles. There are numerous citations in the order where the trial court, and particularly the magistrate, indicates, for example, that the statutes have largely constrained equity within the child support area. The trial court erroneously found that the magistrate was forbidden to make adjustments to the retroactivity of a motion. The trial court made findings showing that if it applied equity, it said, for example, to apply equity, to do otherwise would undermine the rule of law. Now, I'm asking the Court of Appeals to look at the tone of this order and see that this trial court refused to apply rules of equity. What makes this important on the standard of review is it is not a question of whether the trial court applied principles of equity and found my client wanting in them and denied them, but it refused to apply them at all. And the case law, and I cite in my standard of review, is that in that case, the standard of review is not abuse of discretion, but the Court of Appeals, it's de novo. And because it's de novo and this matter has to go back to the trial court because of the errors of law. Now, including in these rules of equity, there are two statutes I want to refer to. The one statute refers to the situation where children are living with an obligor with the consent of the other parent, and that the child the law 518.36 permits the court to find that the child support obligation is satisfied. So if it's satisfied, even though it might be ordered, it's a question of equity. So you shouldn't have to pay child support in cash if it's been in kind. And the second statute, which I think that the trial court erred on, is the statute about the apparent expense adjustment, which there's a subdivision 3 to MnSTAT section 518A.36 called calculation of basic support when parenting time is equal. That statute states that if parenting time is equal, and it was, and the parties have equal incomes, and they were, that no basic child support shall be paid unless the court determines that the expenses for the child are not equally shared. Now, this is hotly contested by the other side. They say, well, no, I'm saying that that is a separate freestanding statute as part of the parenting time expense adjustment statute. The parenting time expense adjustment statute, to get that adjustment, there must be an order. That's what the statute says. But subdivision 3 does not require an order. It simply says that there is no child support when the two equalities exist. I want to call the attention of the court too that I believe the county brief, they say, well, you know, Mr. Seeloff is obviously wrong because in subdivision 1 of 518.836, it refers to parenting time expense as applied to this section. And I just want to call the attention to the court that reference that counsel is erroneous. Subdivision 3 of 518A.36 only refers to parenting time, not parenting time percentage.
Mr. Seeloff, can you point us to a case that supports that argument?
Well, one of my arguments is that...
question is, can you point us to a case, precedential authority in the state of Minnesota that supports your interpretation?
I cannot, Your Honor, but I think it's unnecessary because the Constitution delegates to the legislature the authority to make statute for family law. Merely because a court hasn't ruled on the subject doesn't mean that there's no authority. So the lack of authority by the court is not necessary for a law to be efficacious. But I want to just finish a second. The argument is that MidStat section 518.836 subdivision 3 refers to parenting time. Parenting time is a defined term under 518.8.003. And parenting time under that definition does not require a court order. So the argument that the respondent county is making actually is an argument in my favor. And I would submit that the plain language of the statute provides that. But that section is only part of the broad criticism and error of the court when it refused to apply any equity to the case.
I'd like to shift. Let's say, for the sake of argument, we don't agree with you on the point you're making. does that affect the award of $999 in conduct-based attorney's fees?
Yes, it does.
Okay, well, how? Because unless I'm wrong, you only addressed the first finding, insisting that a parenting expense adjustment be applied although there was no parenting order. I did not see any response as to the conduct-based fees relating to your insisting that a retroactive modification of child support by decreasing the arrears, failing to pay one penny in child support since October 2019, telling respondent's attorney that appellant had made it clear this is not going to stop until the arrears and current support obligations are corrected, and violating the parenting consulting agreement not to bring motions until a parenting time was established. Did you address any of those issues in your brief? I did not see them, but
first, Your Honor, on the question why he didn't pay child support is because the children were living with both parties,
that depends on your interpretation of the statute, doesn't it? And your arguments. If we disagree with that, what I'm asking here is for example, violating the parenting consulting agreement not to bring motions until a parenting time schedule was established. I did not see anything in your brief relating to that aspect of the conduct-based attorney's fees. I was wondering perhaps if you could address that point of the order.
I think in the transcript it shows that the respondent that brought the child support motion, but my client brought this before the court because he was expecting the child custody issues to be resolved informally, but it wasn't happening, and so he was forced to do it. And so
the question are you telling is that me he that, may have, that he a may defense, have agreed to that? Excuse me, sir, what, sir. All right, Mr. Seale, I just want to make sure I understand your client's position. Are you telling me that he has the right not to obey court orders because he thinks they're wrong?
I'm just saying that was his reason.
His reason, isn't that an argument to impose conduct-based attorney's fees? Or excuse me, not an argument, but a reason to impose them.
Well,
end of the day, you can appeal decisions you don't like with, but I think the law is pretty clear that in the interim, you have to obey them. And that if you don't, or get them stayed until pending appeal, but if you don't obey them, there are consequences to that. I'm almost positive of that.
Well, I hardly can dispute that.
Okay.
My read of the award of the child support by the judge, not by the magistrate. The magistrate just kind of recommended, but the judge made a finding, and the judge, I understood the order to say that it was because of his insistence that the parenting expense adjustment should be made.
Right.
But
I'm
my,
not so sure I agree, but okay. But I understand
my argument. My argument is he didn't insist on that. What he was arguing was the application of equity. And the court refused to apply equitable considerations at all.
So Sam, I'd like to ask a different question, and that is with respect to the district court's findings on the subsequent winding down of appellant's sunlight window and door business, and then the institution and incorporation of a sunlight limited business by appellant's second wife or new wife. And the district court explicitly found that this was a sham designed to create the illusion of reduced income. We generally defer to district court's credibility determinations. So why should we even consider overturning based on the district court's findings that appellant engaged in a sham?
Well, because there was no facts to support the sham. There was no evidence of any income. There was no evidence that my client had done anything. The only evidence they had was that his wife had incorporated this organization to, quote, wind down things. My client, I think the record says he didn't even know that this occurred. There's not a scintilla of evidence that that there was any income. The county did a research of his income records and didn't find anything. He says he didn't earn any income. But see, what I find is that this is pure speculation. So there's the mere fact that there was a corporation created by his wife without anything else proves nothing.
But what you have here is you have the district court. I mean, the district court is going to apply common sense. At the very same time that appellant is winding down his sunlight business, his wife is incorporating a sunlight business. And I mean, the district court is making a credibility determination here as to the story that your client is telling. And the district court rejected that and said, no, it's pretty apparent what is going on here. The fact that your client hasn't produced those records doesn't seem to contradict that. So why shouldn't we defer to that district court credibility determination?
Well, I'll just say this, is that even if the evidence that was presented to court is true, it doesn't prove anything. It is pure speculation that there was any money there. My client testified that the last time he got any income from this company or from his business was April of 2019. There wasn't a scintilla of evidence that there was any other income paid to anybody. And so my argument is that the under 518.3(2), which is the potential income statute, the statute says that it provides criteria whereby you can impute income. Now, and it's apparent probable earnings level based on employment potential, recent work history, occupational qualifications, and so on. There was no evidence of any of that. And my argument to the court is that just because there was this anecdotal possibility that there was something going on by my client's wife does not authorize a substitution of that anecdotal finding for the statutory requirement that the determination of potential income must be made.
Thank you, Mr. Seeloff. Your time has expired. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondents. I wasn't quite sure. Ms. Clyburn, are you going first? Or
I am, Your Honor.
All right, then we'll reset. Oh, I think the marshals already reset the clock. Then Ms. Clyburn, if you could just tell us who you are in a loud voice, and you may begin, please.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Joanna Clyburn and I represent respondent Michelle Marie Hines. Appearing on behalf of co-respondent Dakota County is assistant county attorney, Ms. Britta Carnine. As the court has noted, we are splitting our time for this argument. Ms. Carnine will address actual and potential income. I will address the VA disability and employability, as well as the parenting expense adjustment and any other questions the court may have. Respondent humbly requests that this court affirm the district court's order dated July 29th, 2020, written and decided by Judge Rochelle Wahi, and the order dated June 1st, 2020, written and decided by Child Support Magistrate Maria K. Pasteur. Both orders denied appellant's motion to modify his ongoing child support obligation. As the court is probably aware, this case has a bit of procedural history attached to it and repeated attempts at another bite at the apple. It started all back in October 15, 2019 as part of the expedited process where the court found appellant had voluntarily closed his construction business shortly before the hearing and imputed income based on his personal and business tax returns provided by the appellant. Appellant's $6,985 in monthly income was based on his monthly 70% disability rating from the VA, receiving pay in the amount of $2,257, and imputed monthly income of $4,728 from his construction business. Judgment was docketed on October 18, 2019, and a notice of entry by attorney was served and filed with the court October 21, 2019. The time to appeal the underlying child support magistration's decision and findings ran on December 20th, 2019. When the appellant filed a motion review, he filed it as a motion for child support modification, but the issues raised were really, in fact, a motion for review. The child support magistrate denied the motion and had found that while the VA disability rating had increased to 100%, it did not render the appellant incapable of finding substantial or gainful employment.
And then do you base that, Ms. Clyburn, on the VA's letter?
So, Your Honor, the VA's letter in itself, and I can go into the differences of type of VA, but the VA letter specifically stated that appellant was not awarded total disability unemployability compensation. Both the child support magistrate and the district court read and specifically looked at that order to make that determination. Furthermore, at that time, appellant provided no other information at all in regards to his ability or inability to earn additional income or how the imputation of income of the underlying order had somehow changed to the current order.
Ms. Clyburn, Mr. Seeloff, is saying that in terms of the corporation issue that Judge Reyes thoughtfully touched on, that his client, that all you've got is, you know, the second wife, you know, incorporated the new corporation, and his testimony that, well, there is no income. Would you explain what evidence did the district court or the magistrate or both rely on in imputing the income based on the incorporation of the new entity?
So the court looked at not just the incorporation documents, but appellant's testimony. And appellant was unable, nor did he raise that he was not aware of this incorporation, but rather he stated that the new LLC had to be created in order to wind down the old LLC. When it came to the income, he provided no additional income. But the issue becomes then, at what point where someone intentionally reduces their income, can wait a period of time and then state, well, I haven't made any income in the last 2 years, therefore, I'm no longer bound to that initial imputation of income without providing any additional information on their ability or previous ability to have earned that income, which the court looked at the business and personal tax returns.
So, Ms. Clyburn, are you aware? I have to admit, I am not. So this is all new to me, but I've never heard that you had to create a new incorporation in order to dissolve the old one. Did counsel for the appellant or the appellant himself testify that recite to some statute that says you that's how you do it now in Minnesota?
No, Your Honor. In fact, no one could explain why that was the case. And while in law school, I can't say I did great in business corporations class, it was not anything that I'm aware of in that case.
Well, I'm sure you did better than the panel. And I am aware of no law that requires that. And so I guess is the suggestion that perhaps as Judge Reyes was inquiring, that based on those answers, the district court was making credibility determinations as it related to the imputed income, and as it's and specifically did not believe the appellant when he testified as to this winding down issue.
I do believe that, and hence the court specifically takes the time to call it a sham, and specifically cites that in their order. In fact, Judge Wahi, when reviewing the magistrate's order, questioned both parties, and still appellant was not able to provide any sound reason or logic as to that issue.
Could you briefly, I know Ms. Carnine in her brief indicated that the county takes no position on the conduct-based fees. Would you briefly summarize your arguments in favor of us affirming the decision on conduct-based fees, please?
Yes, Your Honor. So the district court didn't abuse their discretion awarding those fees. Basically, in this case, there were multiple factors that the court cited. There was actually a Rule 119 affidavit with CV submitted as part of the court's record. And when they went through it, the judge actually specifically laid out all of the issues. And the failure to pay child support to date was one of the issues. The ability to continue to argue and bring motion after motion. And there was evidence submitted that there was basically a statement that he would not continue, or he would continue until this matter was resolved, even though the judgment was no longer appealable under law. Your Honors, I see that my time is up. May I finish the statement?
Yes, please finish your thought, Ms. Clyburn.
So I think when we look at that, the court did a very comprehensive review of all the factors in here. A lot more attorney's fees have expended than $999. But in this case, it's clear that only the one issue raised by appellant is not indicative of the record of the court, Your Honor. At this time, subject to any other questions, I will cede my time to Ms. Carnine.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Ms. Carnine, you may begin. Please just first tell us your full name for the record, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Britta Carnine. I am the Assistant County Attorney for Dakota County on behalf of co-respondent Dakota County in this case. May it please the court, I would like to address the issue of the calculating of actual income and imputing potential income to the appellant. As previously stated, appellant does argue that the district court inappropriately used actual income and potential income to calculate a total gross monthly income for child support, when in fact, the court may reference Welsh v. Welsh, that's 775 Northwest 2nd, 364, at 369 states specifically that it is appropriate to include actual and potential income to compute gross monthly income when considering child support. There is no error in doing both. The district court used the appellant's VA disability pay as his actual income and then imputed potential income based on a monthly average of his last few years of business income. Now, appellant argues that because the district court did not specifically state in the order that appellant was, quote, voluntarily unemployed, underemployed, or employed on a less than full-time basis, end quote, from the statute, that this means that the district court's findings as to potential income are erroneous. Now, Minnesota Statute 518A.32 subdivision 1 states that if a parent is voluntarily unemployed, underemployed, or employed on a less than full-time basis, the child support must be calculated based on a determination of potential income. The statute does not specifically require the court to actually use that statutory language in its order when calculating potential income. And in fact, there is no statute or case law that I am aware of that requires these specific words to be used when imputing or calculating potential income. In the child support magistrate's order, the magistrate found, as we have mentioned on the record already, that the appellant had created the sham designed to create an illusion of reduced income. And immediately after this finding in her order, the magistrate goes on to state the appellant continues to have the ability to earn $4,728 gross monthly income. The magistrate also made numerous other findings, noting how appellant had previously been found to be voluntarily unemployed in the October 2019 order, and that he had not submitted any other information that would prove that he is medically unable to work. The appellant argues that these findings are too ambiguous to justify imputing potential income. However, the interpretation of the magistrate's findings are made even more clear when she uses the $4,728 per month in the potential income column of the child support guidelines worksheet attached to her order. The county's position is that her findings were sufficient in explaining why she found appellant to be voluntarily unemployed.
But doesn't that require the CSM's findings to really hinge on speculation of what is actually occurring here? Because there doesn't seem to be a lot of facts. So it seems to be more speculation on the part of the child support magistrate.
I would agree that the magistrate had to rely on a very thin set of facts here. I think that in this case, the magistrate did refer back to the October 15th, 2019 order, where she states that in that case or in that court hearing, he testified, Mr. Wertweger testified that there's snowflakes that don't want to work and he's frustrated with them. That was apparently referring to his employees. And the magistrate also referenced in the prior order that if the father is in fact no longer operating his business, this appears to be a voluntary choice that he has made. I believe the magistrate was relying on previous findings from the first sort of bite at the apple in this case, so to speak. And then also findings based on sort of what might be going on. I would agree there is some speculation there because there was so little for the magistrate to go on.
Is there anything in the record indicating that the New Sunlight LLC is operating a business same as the prior Sunlight company?
There was nothing in the record because the appellant did not provide any tax returns from 2019. And because it's a self-employed business, there's nothing for the county to be able to see on our deed wage records for them as well. So the county had nothing else to provide. The court had nothing else to look at, would go towards my argument that additionally that the magistrate utilized what she had available based on previous income that I would argue is recent enough to be considered recent work history based on the facts of this case. Then I would like to turn over my remaining time to Ms. Clyburn to address the parenting expense adjustment briefly.
Okay. Ms. Clyburn.
Thank you, Your Honor. So in this particular case, the child support magistrate didn't make any errors of law in refusing to apply the parenting expense adjustment, nor did the court fail to abuse its discretion by refusing to supplement the statutes with equitable principles, specifically 518.8.36 subdivision 1B says if there's no court order, the allocation of parenting time shall be determined without consideration of parenting expense adjustment. It's very clear from our statutes and our case law that when the words of the law are clear and free of any and all ambiguity, the statute controls. What is in a trying to apply Minnesota Statute 518A.38 subdivision 3, what appellant is trying to do is attempt to argue another statute that's not even under the parenting expense adjustment or is meant to apply to the parenting expense adjustment. Clearly, if the legislature had wanted to express some sort of adjustment for that, it could have done so within the statute itself. The other piece to this is that the appellant's argument has misinterpreted, I believe, the statutory and case law as it relates to that adjustment. The child support magistrate was not required to consider equitable principles in this case. Rather, it may consider these principles, not shall. Appellant claims they were operating under a near equal schedule, but provided no evidence other than a calendar that was minimally filled out. The appellant tries to shift the burden to respondent, saying that she failed to notify the court of the equal parenting time, but it was not her burden to prove. There was no consent, and there was no consent acknowledged by respondent that would allow for the satisfaction of support as indicated in that 518A.38 subdivision 3. Additionally, appellant makes an assumption the court would have imposed parenting schedule that was equal. And if it had done so, the party's income was equal. Clearly, the court did not find that. It did not find the party's income equal, nor did it find the credibility of the appellant that they were, in fact, sharing an equal schedule. Your Honors, my time is done. I rest on the remainder of respondent's brief.
Thank you, Ms. Claiborne. Thank you, Ms. Carnine. Mr. Seeloff, you will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal, sir.
Well, first, what I get out of these arguments is that their arguments is that the trial court relied on things that it did with the 2019 order, and it's argued that that's sufficient for the 2020 order, but then argues on the other side of their mouth that the 2020 order, when it's remanded, which I hope it will be, can't affect anything in 2019. There's an inherent contradiction there. The point I want to make is that every motion stands on its own. My client brought a motion in 2020, asked for relief, and on the imputation of income, the court must then make the same findings in 2020, must make findings in 2020 on the imputation of income, and cannot just rely on what they did in 2019. If that were the case, imputation of income would be forever, because if you couldn't change the basis for the imputation in the past, then you can never do so. In my brief, I do cite a case, a 1987 case, where there was a circumstance where income was imputed, and they said that the court had failed in the subsequent motion to make the appropriate findings, and therefore imputation had to cease. Another point I want to make is that the inconsistency is that in the magistrate refused to apply equity, but the district court refused to apply the law. There's not, even though if you look at the transcript,
Mr. Seeloff, do you agree with, I think it was Ms. Claiborne. I mean, as to equity, the statute says may, not shall. So if it's may, how is it an error not to apply it?
Well, the distinction
if it didn't apply it.
The distinction is that the court has the authority to apply equitable principles.
Okay? Right, and it has the authority not to apply it either. So if the court didn't apply it under statute that says may, I in the Hans Hagen case, I thought shall meant shall, but the Supreme Court said shall meant may. However, in this case, I'm pretty sure the statute's not the reverse. May doesn't mean shall. So if may doesn't mean shall, I'm at a loss to understand how this was error.
What you're referring to the statute that allows the court to satisfy.
Right. And I thought you were the one who told me in the beginning of your argument that it's the statutes that count because the legislature passes them so that if you don't need a case. So if the statute says that, why would I look at any cases if the statute is may?
Well, my point on it, Your Honor, is that the court did not even consider the application of equitable principles. My point, but that the court made all of these findings about the how awful it would be that if to do otherwise would undermine the rule of law. But see, there's a difference between a court applying equitable principles and say, well, you lose, and saying, I'm not going to apply them at all. And if they don't apply them at all, it's reversible error. That's what I'm trying to say.
How is it reversible error if they're given the discretion, as Judge Connolly points out, it's may, it's not shall. It would be different if they were required to, but the district court is not required to impose or apply equitable principles.
Well, because there should be a finding. I mean, the whole history of the
is there any case law requiring a finding on whether or not to consider equitable principles?
The standard review simply says, and I cite the case, is that if there's a difference in the standard review as to where a court applies equitable principles and then you lose, and where a court refuses to apply them at all. And I don't make the law, I'm just citing the statute.
Right, but let me change gears real quick because we're running out of time. Can you address, I'm curious in terms of Minnesota statute section 518A.32, 2, subdivision 1, it seems that you're trying to read into the statute that the word only into based on a determination of potential income. Can you provide any case law support for your position that actual income and potential income are mutually exclusive?
You mean that you can't do both?
Correct.
No, my answer to that is that because my client was found to be permanently and totally disabled, that the logic in this case is that you can't attribute that potential, full potential income, because there's an impairment of his ability to earn. And the Bonin letter and the statute clearly indicate that. But when you have a totally disabled person, you can't say, well, you can work and get your disability pension too. There's a factual inconsistency, where there's some theoretical.
Thank you, Mr. Seeloff. Your time has expired. We appreciate the arguments made by counsel for the appellant and counsel for the respondents. We will issue our decision in 90 days.